Good morning, all. This is Arne Hackett in Raleigh. I'd like to welcome you once again to the continuation of our IPv6 session. Today we have Gus Kasimis picking up just about where he left off last time, and we have Roy Brabson. They're both of the ComServer Design and Strategy Group. Today's session is being recorded. So with that, I'll let Gus take it away.
So in terms of picking up from where we left off, we're going to backtrack just a couple of charts. We try to find a good logical stop point. So we're going to pick it up with chart 27, for those that may not be on the conference and just following along, which is the coexistence and migration section. So just to level set, what we spent most of the time in the previous call was going through some of the motivation for IPv6 in terms of what's driving the need for the new protocol, focusing in on the fact that the IP addressing space was the key driver of that. And we did go through the IP addressing, what does it look like for IPv6, and we also talked briefly about some of the IPv6 features. So in this section here, and I'm mentioning that just in case there's folks that are joining just for this call that weren't able to make the previous one. In this section here, we'll be talking about how to begin thinking about deploying IPv6, coexistence, migration considerations, and so forth. So moving on to chart 28, two of the key themes we'll be looking at from a transition perspective is the first one being how are we able to share the same physical network to be able to use both IPv4 and IPv6 concurrently, right? Because ideally here we don't want to string another physical network just for being able to support IPv6. And we'll see that with IPv6, the nice thing is that you can basically have multiple protocols, both V4 and V6, share the same actual network fabric. So there's standard technologies there that will allow us to share that. We'll be talking about another key concept, which is the dual mode stack, which is a TCP/IP stack that supports both version 4 and version 6 IP protocols concurrently. So that'll be another key technology that we'll spend quite a bit of time on. And then we'll also be talking about cases where perhaps you don't have IPv6 connectivity end-to-end, and that's sort of depicted in this picture here where you see a couple of IPv6 networks, but then the wide area network in between those being IP version 4. How are we able to have communications flow across those three networks in IPv6 format? So there we'll be talking about technologies like tunneling of IPv6 over IPv4 networks. Secondary, the thing that we'll be looking at is how about applications and what is the application impact? If you recall, in the last discussion, we talked about the fact that there are changes that are required for applications to be able to communicate using IPv6. So we'll be talking about scenarios where perhaps you have applications that have not been enabled for IPv6 and what are the implications there. Can an IPv6 client communicate with those? So there's various additional technologies that we'll look at. The dual TCP/IP stack comes into play, so that covers both issues here. But we'll also talk about other technologies such as application layer gateways that can be used to mediate between applications communicating with V6 and applications that can only communicate over V4. And there's various other IPv6 transition technologies that are listed here, and to be honest, we're not going to spend a lot of time on those. Those are usually technologies you can employ out in the network and things that, you may want to look into more detail, on your own. But those are the two layers of issues that we'll be looking at. So transitioning on to page 19, the first question being, is IPv6 something that I ask my network engineering department to go implement and then we're basically done, something that just occurs on the network? And unfortunately, the answer is no, right? Since IPv6 is a fundamental change to the format of IP packets, its most fundamental entity being IP addressing, how we address hosts on an IP network changes, it's pretty pervasive. So basically anything in the network infrastructure that deals with IP packets, things like routing, for instance, right, certainly cares about IP addresses. So there's changes there for IPv6 routing protocols. for change to OSPF for OSPF version 3 that supports dynamic routing with IPv6, changes to protocols like ARP, as we talked about before, we have with IP version 4, there's neighbor discovery, so any entities participating on those networks need to be aware and enabled for that new protocol. The Internet Control Message Protocol, ICMP, there is ICMP as you know it today for V4, and there's a new protocol, ICMP version 6, to be able to accomplish similar types of tasks in an IPv6 world. Moving on, things like name servers, right? The main name servers that map host names to IP addresses, those need to be updated to be able to support both V4 and V6 addresses. If you're using DHCP to do dynamic IP configuration and you wish to do that, continue to use that model in the V6 world, there's updates there to the DHCP protocol for V6 as well. So in summary, anything in the network that touches IP packets and cares about IP packet format, things like layer 3 routers, firewalls, any intrusion detection devices you may have in your wide area network, any application layer gateways, et cetera, basically need to be examined, right, to determine whether they're IPv6 capable, and then, you know, looking into what does it take to IPv6 enable those functions. Moving on from that, so a lot of impact, obviously, on the network infrastructure. In terms of the physical networks that you have today, right, your Ethernet networks that your ZOS systems are attached to, that physical media can carry both V4 and V6. So there's really not talking about new cabling. We're not talking about, you know, new switches and so forth. We'll take a look at what that means specifically from a ZOS perspective. Every TCP/IP stack that sits on the network that wants to support IPv6 communication needs to be updated for that. Now, the good news is most TCP/IP stacks that are out there for the various vendors all are enabled for IPv6. There may be some steps that you need to take, right, in order to actually enable that IPv6 capability. So we'll talk about that in the context of ZOS here, right? The fact that, you know, we've had an IPv6 enabled stack for a very long time, but most of you are not exploiting that functionality today. Finally, IPv6, one of the key impacts it has is that it does impact the API, which is referred to as a sockets interface that most applications and middleware use to communicate over TCP/IP. The key thing there is that the sockets interface as we know it today provides visibility. When you create a socket to communicate, let's say over TCP or UDP, you expressly indicate what address family you support. So today, IPv4 programs, they open sockets, they specify address family INET or AFINET, basically indicating that it's going to communicate with IPv4 hosts. The reason it does that is that in the socket API, there are structures that get exchanged between the application and TCP/IP that contain things like IP addresses. So therefore, if the IPv6 address is four times as large as IPv4, you can see here that this cannot be done transparently, as there's no means, right, to be able to map 128 bits into 32 bits of memory that current applications are used to. So applications enabling for IPv6 need to expressly indicate that when they create a socket, they want to support AFINET 6, which is the IPv6 address family. And note that applications that enable for IPv6, the nice thing is once they create an AFINET 6 socket, they can use that socket to communicate with V4 and V6 partners, right? So an IPv6 capable application is capable of communicating with both V4 and V6. That's a key concept. So that's another aspect of this. Now, in most cases, it's a question of obtaining the proper version of middleware that you're running that's IPv6 enabled, and most, you know, products, IBM and OEM, you know, have probably upgraded for IPv6 support as of now. But you also need to take a look at whether you have in your shops any programs that use sockets, the socket API directly, right? Because that would be an impact to your own applications, right? For certain other programs where, for instance, you have a Kix application that may underneath the covers be invoked by, you know, transparently as part of a web service invocation, you know, there you don't really need to worry about upgrading that business logic for IPv6 if that application is not performing the communication on its own. But for other programs which are sockets aware, there will be an impact. So moving on to chart 30 and talking about the TCP/IP dual mode stack. So this term is a term that you will hear generically in the industry in regard to IPv6. And the first thing I just want to point out is that a dual mode TCP/IP stack here is a TCP/IP stack that supports both V4, IPv4, and IPv6 concurrently. It is not to be confused on ZOS with running multiple TCP/IP stacks inside the single ZOS system image, right? Or what we refer to as common INET, right? We'll talk a little bit about common INET implications with dual stacks, but again, here, a dual stack here implies a single TCP/IP stack that supports both V4 and V6. So if we take a look at what this structure looks like, you start out at the very top with applications that may be IPv4 only applications, in which case they create AF INET sockets, and then you have applications that have been enabled for IPv6 and they create AF INET 6 sockets, right? So regardless of which path you took from the application perspective, the next layer down, right, at some point, the request will get handed to a common TCP and UDP layer, right? And in that layer is where we will determine whether we're communicating with a peer that's using that's IPv4 addressable or with a peer that we want to be able to use IPv6 addressability to reach that peer. So the common transport layer, TCP and UDP, are pretty much operating in the same mode that they do today. They are aware of V4 and V6 because they need to understand which layer the TCP/IP protocol stack to hand things to. They are aware that IP addresses have changed and so forth, but the logic of the TCP protocol pretty much unchanged at that layer. So depending on whether we're communicating with an IPv4 partner, we would route it to the right half there, and we'll see that that's the IPv4 layer that you have today that everybody is using that has IPv4-specific logic, right, understands IPv4 addressing, address resolution protocol, has support for ICMP for V4, has support for IGMP if you're using multicast type of functionality for your V4 network. You also have in that IPv4 box all the additional qualities of service we built into TCP/IP, things like network quality of service policies, intrusion detection services, and IPsec for IPv4. Now, if the path was to, we're trying to communicate with an IPv6 partner using IPv6 addresses, we would have taken the left fork in the road there, right, where we pass the request on to the IPv6 layer. And there, starting first with qualities of service, you'll see that, largely the same qualities of service that you have today with IPv4 are also provided for IPv6 as well. Now, I will say that was a, we built that functionality up in terms of IPv6 over time. So you'll see there that in parentheses we have IDS. The reason that's in parentheses is that's one that we're enabling in ZOS V1R13. So in ZOS V1R13, you'll have intrusion detection services enabled for IPv6 as well. But the key thing that's in the IPv6 box is that that's where we have all the logic that can now understand IPv6 packets, that it can implement all the necessary protocols required for an IPv6 host. So that includes things like neighbor discovery, MLD for multicast support in that environment in IPv6, stateless address auto configuration, and the ICMP version 6 protocol. Right. So, again, the IP layers kind of sit side by side, right, and we see that one path to them occurs by the transport layer deciding where to route packets to. Further down, underneath the two layers of IP, we have some common device driver data link functions. Those are device driver functions that will then also take a fork of the road there to basically invoke either an IPv6-specific device driver or an IPv4 device driver. So from a networking perspective, further down you'll see that there's a single network interface adapter, right, that basically connects to your network. So that could be your OSA, right? And you can see there that on a single port, OSA port, right, connected into a switch port, you can basically have both V4 and V6 traffic basically flow over that single port in the single OSA. From an operating system perspective, the key thing to note is that if you're using an OSA to connect to your network, let's say a single OSA adapter, logically from a TCP/IP perspective, you would have two network interfaces. defined to your ZOS TCP/IP stack, one for IPv6 and one for IPv4. But again, they can map to the same exact physical adapter, same exact physical port into the network. So just finally, the reverse flow is also true. As packets come in from the network, they come in from the network adapter, they get handed either to our IPv6 device driver or our IPv4 device driver, depending on whether it's IPv4 or IPv6 traffic. And then they get routed to the appropriate IP layer, V4 or V6, again, depending on those same rules, and then up to the stack. So one other thing to consider here is if you, the two boxes I didn't talk about is there is a raw transport available for V4 and there's one available for V6. That basically is for very specialized applications that basically construct their own IP headers, if you will. And for those, there's an IPv4 version of the transport and one for IPv6. And those applications that use those overtly have to select which transport they want to be able to use at the application layer. So just as an example of that, things like the ping command is an application that basically uses the raw transport for the specialized processing that it needs to do. So typically not something that you would need to worry about in your applications. Okay, so fundamental concept, that's basically, in a nutshell, what the dual mode stack is, but this is a key concept, right, that enables a TCP/IP host to support both V4 and V6 communications concurrently and extend them all the way up to the application layer. So moving on to chart 31, taking a look at some scenarios where we make use of the dual mode stack. In this example here, we have three hosts on the network. We have an IPv6 only node, so that node basically only has IPv6 network connectivity. Again, now we show there a mainframe in the back. That's probably not as likely. You know, it's probably more likely to be, you know, a lightweight IP device, maybe something like a smartphone that may only have connectivity for IPv6. But the middle one shows an IPv4 only node, so that's a node that has not been updated or enabled for any IPv6 communications. And then finally, on the right hand side, we have a dual mode node. So that's where we have a host that basically enabled through a dual mode stack for communicating over V4 and V6 concurrently. Further, on that dual mode node, we have an application that's been enabled for AFINET 6 sockets. So recall what we indicated before. That means that the application can now communicate with both V4 and V6 applications. So in that example, if we take a look at the IPv6 only node, the leftmost node communicating with a dual mode node, that obviously works just using IPv6 across the whole path. We'll use IPv6 addresses, right, to communicate to that host. It comes up the dual mode host up to the common TCP layer, gets presented to the application. So the interesting part is, what about the IPv4 only node? When it connects, it's just connecting using its IPv4 destination address. That packet is an IPv4 packet, flows over the same physical wires potentially, up through the network adapter, and gets handed to the IPv4 part of the dual mode stack. It hands it up to the TCP layer, and it gets presented all the way up to the application. The key thing there is that because this packet now came in using V4, how do we differentiate when we're making displays of the two clients? Given that the server is AFINET 6 enabled, how do we represent that V4 address in a manner that allows that IPv6 enabled application to display it properly, understand its meaning, and so forth? So that's where, if you recall from the previous presentation, we talked about this special format of an IPv6 address that starts with colon, colon, FFFF, and then followed by the dotted decimal address. That's an IPv4 mapped IPv6 address, and that's an example of where it would get used. So if you did a NetSat display for connections to this server on the dual mode host, you would basically see one connection using IPv4 mapped IPv6 addresses and the other one using native IPv6 addresses. Okay, so we have no questions on that. Moving on to the next chart, chart 32, and looking at a variation of this theme, where we do have basically the same topology as we had before. The thing that changes is we have a dual mode node where we basically enabled that dual mode node to communicate over V4 and V6, but we did not enable the application for IPv6 communication. So the application comes up and opens up an AFINET socket. Remember, at that point, that application is now confined to only communicating over IPv4. So in that scenario, the IPv4 path works just fine, and we need to do no special mapping in terms of displaying the addresses and so forth. But if the IPv6-only application tries to communicate with that host, it can certainly send a packet to the destination IP address of that dual-mode host, right? Because that host does have IPv6 connectivity. The IPv6 layer gets the packet, hands it off to the transport layer, to the TCP or UDP layer, but that layer cannot surface, right, that connection request up to that IPv4 application because it has no way of being able to represent that V6 address, right, in 32 bits. So basically, that communication path, even though network connectivity-wise is enabled, we don't have connectivity end-to-end all the way up to the application. Okay, so if you're in that scenario, are you stuck? So let's go on to chart 33 that shows some possible mitigations for those types of environments where you may have an IPv6-only client, right, and doesn't have to be a client. We could reverse the roles here. And then that needs to communicate to a node that's IPv4-only. So on the right-hand side there, we have a host that has only IPv4 connectivity. Now, we'll look at a couple of examples on this. The first one is that you look at the dual-mode node in the middle. What you basically have there is you could implement a application layer gateway type of function where you have, let's say in this case, it's a web server is a type of interaction. You could have the IPv6 client connect to the IPv6-enabled application over IPv6. And then you can have that application act as a proxy where it establishes a secondary connection to the back-end application. And it establishes that connection over V4 because that back-end application is only enabled for V4 communications. That application could be sitting on the same node, on that dual-mode node, so in which case they're using IPv4, but those communications are staying within the box. Or we go back to the previous example, let's say if it was on a remote server and that remote node was only IPv4 capable, it would flow over the IPv4 network. So there what we basically have is a proxy in the middle, that web server is basically acting as a proxy. It's enabled to communicate both V4 and V6, so it's taking V6 packets and relaying them over a separate IPv4 connection. Doesn't have to have any real logic in there, right, other than understanding that packets it reads from this pipe, it needs to relay to the secondary pipe and so forth. So this is the notion of having an application layer gateway, right, being able to bridge the gap between applications that are only V4 capable and applications that are V6 capable only. Again, if you have applications that are running on dual mode stacks, and a lot of the applications will be in that mode, you don't really have the issue here of requiring a gateway in between. The back-end application that's V4 only doesn't know that any of this stuff is happening, right? And the same is true for the IPv6-only node, right? As far as they're concerned, they're communicating with either a V6 or V4 partner. Okay, so if there are no questions on that, we can move on to the next chart that basically talks about how do we enable IPv6 support on ZOS. So the first step is that today, in order to enable IP communications on ZOS, even for V4, there is a Unix System Services PALM Live member called BPX PRM that sits in PALM Live, and in there are some network definitions today for IPv4 communications. Specifically, there's a network statement in there today that indicates that you support AFINET, which is IPv4 communications, and then you basically indicate the TCP/IP protocol stacks that are able to handle those requests. So the first step that you need to do today is to enable IPv6 is to go into that PALM Live member and replicate, if you will, your definitions for AFINET, for specifying them as well for AFINET 6. Once you do that, basically what's enabled on the system is the capability for applications to create AFINET 6 sockets. The next step is what occurs underneath the covers there, and in this picture here we have kind of a complicated picture that won't really apply to all environments out there. But if we focus on the middle row there, what we see is at the very bottom is we see a dual-mode TCP/IP stack. That's what ZOS TCP/IP supports. So if you, at a minimum, enable BPX PRM for AFINET 6 support and you have the ZOS TCP/IP stack, we will automatically, based on that one definition, enable now our TCP/IP stack to operate in dual mode. So we will have our IPv6 capabilities basically automatically enabled. by that one statement. That enables applications to open ASI.NET 6 sockets, which again allows that application to support both V4 and V6 communications. It doesn't mean that we have any network connectivity over IPv6, because that's not going to happen until you take an overt action, right, to tell us what network interfaces do you want to enable IPv6 over. But in essence, from an application standpoint, that one statement enables the dual mode stack from a TCP/IP perspective. So that's the most prevalent scenario. So now let's talk about a couple of scenarios that are more peculiar. On the left-hand side, you could theoretically have a TCP/IP stack that only supports IPv6. However, I say theoretically because the ZOS TCP/IP stack can only be configured as a dual mode stack today. It's either IPv4 only or a dual mode stack. At some point in the future, we may give consideration to having a ZOS TCP/IP stack that only supports V6. But for various reasons, right now, we don't see that happening, at least not anytime soon. So that's more of a theoretical example on the left-hand side. On the right-hand side, we're trying to depict a scenario where you have an IPv4-only TCP/IP stack, so a stack that's not enabled for IPv6. That is not the ZOS comm server TCP/IP stack. But that would be the case if you're running one of the OEM TCP/IP stacks that is offered in the marketplace for ZOS. If that OEM stack does not support TCP/IP, and as far as we understand it today, they do not. One of the things that was done was that there was some support that was added in the Unix System Services layer to allow basically that stack to be able to work in an environment where somebody opens up an ASI.NET 6 socket. Underneath the covers, this transform layer relays these IPv6 socket calls into IPv4 socket calls transparently. That sort of works as long as you're using basic IPv6 socket functions. Once you start using advanced socket functions, you could have some issues. The other key thing here is that if you're running in a mixed environment where you want to be able to support both an OEM stack and a dual-mode TCP/IP stack, we recommend you try to isolate those in their own LPARs. Otherwise, there could be complications that you run into. Now, this picture also shows common INET. The rules are pretty much the same. We typically recommend a INET configuration of a single, a TCP/IP stack. But if you have environments where today you have good reasons for supporting multiple IPv4 stacks, you can support multiple dual mode stacks in the same system using common INET. So the rules are sort of similar there. So that's the first basic step to enabling IPv6. Transitioning into chart 35 and talking about, what would change if that's all you did, let's say, in the system. You still don't have network connectivity, but there are some key considerations. First, let's talk about netstat. So we spent a lot of time previously talking about the format of IPv6 addresses. So if there was one thing that you should have gotten out of that is that IPv6 addresses are much longer than IPv4 addresses in both in binary format, but certainly true as well when you're trying to display those as, on various formatted displays such as NetSat. So one of the things that we basically had to contend with is that many of the IPv4 reports today for NetSat would have the local and remote IP address for a given, let's say, TCP connection, all displayed on a single line. And that was fine because it fit. You could actually do that and still stay within the 80-character limit that we have from a NetSat display perspective. However, with V6, that's no longer possible. With up to 45 characters long for each IP address, right, you can't put those side by side on a single display and still, meet some of the character limitations that we have today for legacy displays. So what we've introduced is this long format for NetSat that basically you'll see that anywhere where IP addresses appear, they're no longer side by side, but rather each of those addresses appears on its own line. So that's the display you see at the bottom there is of the long display. So in that environment, for instance, if you had an IPv6 enabled application, even if you're not communicating yet over the network using V6, that's that final connection that you see down there for TN3270A that shows an established form. You'll see there that the local and foreign socket, right, show an IPv4 address, but they show it in an IPv4 mapped IPv4 address format. Okay, So the net of this is that once you enable for IPv6, this long format is not an option. We will always display things in the long format. If you want to start experimenting with how those displays would look at today, even though you're only using V4, you can do that by specifying the short parameter on the netstat command. So you can basically do that on a netstat command basis. Or if you want to be able to change to the new format for the entire system, you can code the ipconfig format long keyword, and then by default, all netstat displays that you issue will now be in the long format. The reason to do this is twofold. One, to get used to the new displays just from a visual perspective, but the other one is to also identify any dependencies that you may have, right, in terms of programs that may be screen scraping netstat output. So if you have any Rex execs that you've written in the past that issue netstat commands, intercept the output, screen scrape that, right, to be able to provide some new display, those programs would definitely have an impact from the long format. So this gives you a way to be able to plan that ahead of time before you enable IPv6. Okay, moving on to chart 36. Let's talk about network connectivity now, switch the discussion to we enabled AFINET, we enabled the dual mode stack. How do we get connectivity externally? So in this example here, we basically look at a test environment. We do recommend that as you start experiment with IPv6 that initially you start with some test LPARs that you may have out there for other purposes to limit, right, the potential impact on any production level systems of introducing IPv6. So in this environment here, we have a test LPAR has a dual mode stack enabled. All right, so on chart 36. So the first step, again, is once you've enabled the dual mode stack through your BPX-PRM member chains, the next thing is defining multiple network interfaces on that dual mode stack, specifically IPv6. So in that example there, we have a dual mode stack on that test LPAR that has two network interfaces, one for V4 and one for V6. Again, they can utilize the same OSEP. Not a requirement, but that's certainly supported. Then you may, you know, try to take a look here at other hosts that you may have on the network, right, that you need to communicate with. So certainly on that test network that test LPAR is connected to, you may have hosts that are V4 only, right? You may have a host that's also dual mode with V4 and V6. And theoretically, you could have a host that's only IPv6. So certainly anything that flows in terms of communications between that test LPAR and that immediately attached network, right, would now support both V4, V6, and any combination of thereof, right? That's pretty simple. The question then becomes is, what if you had a another network that's not directly attached to this test LPAR that you also want to be able to do some testing with? But the problem is that the network in between, right, those subnets is V4 only. So think about cases where you need to reach over to another test site and so forth, and you have not upgraded your entire wide area network for V6 communication. In that example, if we were trying to reach, again, one of the hosts using V6 that was sitting on the bottom network, we could start looking at technologies like tunneling. So the idea there is that as long as you can reach a router, right, in your immediate network that's IPv6 capable, if that router supports a tunneling mechanism, and one of the terms that you want to get used to there is IPv6 over IPv4 tunneling, the idea there is that that router could reach the other router on the remote IPv6 network using V4, but basically establish a special tunnel that allows the two routers to basically take those IPv6 packets that it receives from the IPv6-capable network and encapsulate them into an IPv4 packet. So the idea there is that if you looked at those packets that are flowing in that tunnel, the outer IP packet header would be an IPv4 header, but inside that packet, there would be another IP header in IPv6 format. So we're basically flowing those IPv6 packets as if they were IPv4 packets across a wide area network. They come to the other tunnel endpoint. That tunnel endpoint will then basically discard the outer IPv4 packet, right, and put the IPv6 packet that was encapsulated in there on the IPv6 network directly. So tunneling is a very useful means, right, of being able to bridge pockets of IPv6 networks over a wider area IPv4 network. Key thing here is that this tunneling You would have to look at a router function to provide that, at least from a ZOS perspective. There is no support on ZOS itself to perform this tunneling directly from ZOS to another tunnel endpoint. So you would have to rely on a router-based capability for that function. V4 communications are unaffected by anything we talked about here. So anybody who's using just the V4 protocol on this network here, nothing is really impacted, right? They're not impacted by the tunneling or any of those additional changes. Now, one thing I will mention, I had heard from one customer that their initial test that I thought was interesting was using test ZOSL PARs, but their first step was, hey, we don't even want to flow any IPv6 packets out on the network, but we have two test LPARs, and we could create a separate hypersockets network in between those two and enable that for V6. And that's my initial test. Nothing wrong with starting gradually there, right, and starting even in a domain that's all controlled by ZOS system administrators. All right, so moving on to chart 37, a few words here on IPv6 certifications. There are various bodies out there in terms of being able to provide some standards for how do we tell whether an operating system or other equipment as well is fully IPv6 capable, or what level of functionality from an IPv6 perspective they provide. So there is an IPv6 ready phase one and phase two certification that's available. ZOS has been certified for both phase one and phase two by the IPv6 forum that publishes those standards. Now, the key thing to note there is we list some release levels, and we apologize, these are not completely up to date. For IPv6 readiness, ZOS, we have certification for both phases, and it extends all the way up to ZOS V1R12. The chart here just shows V1R11 is the latest. So V1R12 is supported as well. Other standards we've been pursuing is to satisfy U.S. Department of Defense IPv6 requirements. So there we have gotten certification as well for IPv6, including some of the security, IPv6-specific security criteria that the DoD had published. So that's what you see there with some of the excerpts for what we've been enabled for. We have also had some additional certification that's U.S. government-related for NIST. NIST is the National Institute of Standards and Technology, and they have published some more general IPv6 requirements that impact any U.S. government agency, and we have been certified for those criteria as well, just recently as well. Key thing to note is both the DoD criteria here and the NIST criteria that I mentioned, those are certifications that are achieved through third-party testing, so it is a more rigorous independent testing process that assures that. So, again, this is just FYI as you start looking at other platforms, or if you get questions on what level of functionality is available in IPv6, you at least know that there's formal certifications that are available there. Okay, moving on to chart 38, shifting gears into, you know, some of the planning stages on how you enable IPv6 from a ZOS perspective. Chart 39. First thing, network access. I think we talked about there the fact that your existing network infrastructure, especially from an Ethernet perspective, can carry both V4 and V6 traffic. Same OS Express port, again, being used in this dual capacity. You do need to update your TCP/IP profile, right, to define any IPv6 capable interfaces, and you do need to do that using the interface statement. So a key note there is if you're using device and link statements today, You might have seen that we've introduced the interface statement a while back. Well, when it comes to IPv6 interfaces, they can only be defined using the interface statement. So that just reference to the type of syntax that you will need to use for those IPv6 interfaces. Now, in terms of what types of interfaces you can define, so certainly anything using QDIO to a OSA press device would basically be supported. If you have multipath channel point-to-point links, whether those are SCON CTC links or via XCF, those support both V4 and V6. So that's an option as well. And finally, if you're using hypersockets today for V4, those are also, you have the capability of defining IPv6 hypersocket connections as well. So those are your choices there. IPv6 address selection. So there, you know, as part of experimenting with all that, obviously you need an IPv6 address space, right, that you could play around with. So you could go and obtain that from your ISP. That's certainly one option. The other option that we should mention here is that you can make use of the local IPv6 unicast address space. So if you recall, and again, you may have to go back to your chart for reference, that's the address range that starts with a FC00 prefix. That's similar in notion to the private IPv4 address spaces that you have today, such as the 10 network, right? So those are addresses you're free to play around with within your intranet networks, right? They're never routable, right, externally into the wide area internet. But inside your own network, you're free to go use those. You don't have to go necessarily, allocate those explicitly. Now, the thing I will mention there is that there is a process that does allow you to get a unique prefix for these unicast addresses. So there are ways there that you can go out there if you go to the IANA website where they give you a mechanism that allows you to generate a unique sub-prefix within the FCHARLIE00 prefix. You may ask, why would you want to do that? And the answer has been there is the address space is so large that you can really afford to have your own private internet space, even though you're not going to ever route these externally. And the motivation for going through that process and obtaining a unique one has been that think about cases where you have mergers, right? In the future, if you've ever been through this, and I'm sure with the number of customers we have on the phone here, you've gone through mergers and acquisitions in the past where you basically need to merge two networks into one. Well, what happens today if both networks are using the 10.000 network space? You may have conflicts, and you may have to go renumber one or the other. So by being able to get these unique prefixes, you're also, assured pretty much in the future that if you merge with another company, even if you're using the site, the local unicast address space, that you're not going to have any collisions. So that's something to look into. But in any case, the local IPv6 unicast addresses are very useful for this type of space test. Remember, there is a notion of IPv6 site local addresses. We didn't cover them in this presentation, but if you've ever seen those in the past, those standards have been deprecated, so you don't want to make use of any of those address ranges. Now, a key thing here is that IPv6 addresses would need to be assigned to every physical or logical, if you will, IPv6 interface that you have, and any static wipers that you have, right? You can configure those directly on the interface statement, or you can also have, the IPv6 auto configuration configure your IPv6 addresses on your OSA devices, right? That works perfectly fine. The key thing there is, from a ZOS perspective, you want to have predictable, non-changing IP addresses, and that's what we recommend, that you continue to make use of virtual IP addresses, VIPAs, static and or dynamic, as the case may be, that should be configured manually. Those are the IP addresses that you're going to be using, right, for other hosts that need to reach that ZOS system, right? You want to eliminate any variability that may be introduced by auto-configured addresses, because you don't want to put those in your name servers and have, those be updated every time those addresses change. Using VIPAs, you can do that once and be assured that those are not going to change in the future. Moving to chart 40, DNS setup, you certainly need a DNS server that's IPv6 capable. If you're using a bind-9 version of DNS or higher, those name servers are supporting both V4 and V6 resources, but it does imply that you do need to have your DNS administrator, right, make some changes to be able to do that. So we recommend that you continue using your existing host names that you have today for V4. Continue using those without any changes. Do not change those host names to include IPv6 addresses initially, right? And this is, again, to ensure that there's no impact to your IPv4 communications. We would recommend that you create a new host name where you could have that host name have both V6 and V4 IP addresses assigned. And that would give you the flexibility of testing what this might look like in the future with dual mode connectivity. And optionally, we recommend that you also have a third host name that's defined, that you only have an IPv6 address configured. That way you have full flexibility of using host names, right, and being able to force those to map to V4 addresses, V6 only addresses, or scenarios where they map to both V6 and V4, and the application can decide which IP address to use. Okay. Now, again, I think I mentioned state of auto configuration. If you use that option, those addresses are not going to be stored in DNS, right? You want to be able to have a static VIPA that's stored in DNS so that that's not impacted by a change in the IP address, which is possible with auto-configured addresses over time. The other thing that's very useful that I don't know we mentioned here is in the early testing, you can certainly use your local files that you have defined on the system, right, to map host names into IP addresses. And that may be useful if you don't want to involve your DNS administrators, right, into this picture from day one. There are new files that support not only V4 addresses, but IPv6 addresses as well. Next bullet, determining common INET versus INET. That's very similar to today, right? We typically recommend folks run with INET. It's the simplest configuration, right? And continue to do that if you enable for IPv6 in the future. However, if you are today a multi TCP/IP stack configuration with common INET and you want to be able to enable IPv6 on multiple stacks, you can certainly do that as well, okay? And this is the note that I made before. If you happen to be running an OEM stack that's V4 only and the ZOS TCP/IP stack, that in that scenario, common INET is not recommended if you're going to be exploiting IPv6 functions. And there we would recommend that you run those dual mode stacks isolated from the IPv4 only stacks and separate LPARs. All right, moving along to chart 41. So steps for moving to an IPv6 environment. You know, one of the key things is understanding the IPv6 and IPv4 translator application layer gateway requirements you may have. So this, again, gets into the scenario where you have IPv6-only nodes that need to communicate with applications that are IPv4-only enabled, right? In those scenarios, again, you need an application layer gateway or some sort of outboard protocol converter, right, that would allow those communications to flow. By and large, again, if you're dealing with IPv6-enabled hosts that implement dual-mode stacks, these issues are not going to be present. But again, if you have either the scenario where the endpoints are not supporting IPv6 or applications that have not been updated for IPv6 and you have another client or server application that's IPv6 only, you need to investigate those options. The second bullet talks about network connectivity, so the fact that not the entire network will be IPv6 overnight and you will have pockets of IPv6 networks emerging at the edges, and you may need to be able to traverse an IPv4 network in the middle, right, to be able to reach those remote networks. That's where tunneling capabilities that we mentioned earlier would be very useful, right? So they're establishing IPv6 over IPv4 tunnels across those remote IPv6 networks would be a means of being able to do that. And then really there's little visibility of that beyond the tunnel endpoints themselves. But that's a very useful technology and one that you need to basically be able to plan. Where to establish the tunnels and how far they run and so forth obviously depends on your network topology, firewalls, other things that you may have deployed in your environment. Okay, so getting down to chart 42. We covered a lot of material here, but basically this one summary chart basically indicates that, you know, enabling for IPv6 is not a single one-step process, right? You do basically need to start investigating IPv6 and developing really a multi-step plan for how you could get to IPv6 to a fully enabled IPv6 environment, right? As we mentioned in the last presentation, this is a question that you may start getting from your executives, right, and various venues on, I hear a lot about this IPv6. What does it mean to us? What would it mean for us to be IPv6 enabled, right? So developing a multi-step plan, targeting an environment, a date when you want to be able to be IPv6 enabled, right? Now, this depends a lot on your business objectives, priorities, and what you foresee the need for IPv6 communications will be, right? But certainly, if you have some of those goals in terms of when you want to be IPv6 capable, that would be helpful because that would help you derive the interim checkpoints, right, of what are some of the key activities we need to do to be able to be in that in position to have full IPv6 enablement by that date. you probably need detailed plans for each subset that you're going to take a look at, right? So identifying some of the critical dependencies in the time frames that you're looking at. Never too early to start the planning, right? The need for IPv6, you know, connectivity may arise quickly, right? You may have a business partner, a U.S. government partner that you may need to be able to support IPv6 communications with little advance warning, right? Understanding at which layers of the network that might come, right? That's probably a key thing as well. Full IPv6 realization, we recognize that that's going to take a while before that's the case. But again, starting early, understanding where you might see it first, right, and starting the planning would be very useful. Developing a plan on how to assign IPv6 addresses, real key, right? Just as you probably have some process today for IP version 4, right? How does, you know, a new host that's into the network obtain an address? You probably need a similar process for IPv6. How you coordinate that with your ISPs, right, and so forth, right? So we talked about unique local addresses. Those could also have a key role in to play in the initial stages here for testing and so forth. Understanding your ISP plans, how you're going to get your network connectivity and what their plans are, right, for getting IPv6 enablement and what processes they may have in place for you to be able to request IPv6 addresses, also very important. The next step there, perform a detailed inventory of all systems, right? This is a key step that needs to be done early on, and a step that I wish I could say is a simple one. But basically, anything that deals with network communications, be it your network infrastructure, right, your servers, or the application and middleware that you execute that you have on your systems, right? Understanding which one of those is IPv6 capable, when. Is it on versions of that hardware software that you have today and simply a matter of enabling them, or will it require an upgrade to either hardware or firmware and or software, right, to be able to get that capability? That's another thing that would be a crucial step. That also includes any applications that are homegrown in your shop as well that are socket-based, right? You would then need to enable, you know, plans to ensure that all the components, right, are enabled in a workable time frame. So that may mean tracking, right, what's the next upgrade of a middleware version, because that will give us IPv6 capability and so forth, working with all the vendors, right, to understand their plans and so forth, at least for all the critical components that you require. Next step, determining how end users will use IPv6, right? So that basically means, you know, what are the likely communication patterns, be it through client true end users to servers, where IPv6 may get introduced, or it could be server-to-server communications as well, right? And that's relevant, especially for ZOS, when you have a fair amount of communications into the ZOS system, may not be driven directly by a client, right, but some intermediate server. So when will you need it, between which tiers, between which network segments, right? And where will you require, you know, tunneling type of capabilities and application layer gateways, right, to be deployed? So finally, deploying IPv6, you also need to worry about education and training within your staff, right? Everybody who's used to dealing with an IPv4 address would need some level of education on what IPv6 is. Some less than others, right? Some more than others, right? So understanding that if you're leading the effort in IPv6 evaluation, on also ensuring that the right folks within your enterprise also get the appropriate level of education. In any case, that brings us to really the summary of this presentation. I know it's a lot of information to consume here, but at this point we'll pause a little bit and see if there are any questions folks have.
And with that, I'll end the session. Take care.